Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit mofad.org.
So this is Pauly Shore. I'm here in, is it Bushwick?
It's Bushwick.
Bushwick, and we're here at Roberto's. And Roberta's, and we're on Heritage Radio. We're talking about food. We're talking about, you know, big glasses, and we're talking about all the man buns. And you're listening to The Morning After.
Episode 185 of The Morning After. I am your host, Sari Kamen. I am here in studio with my guests, Liz Alpert and Jeffrey Yaskovitz. They are the duo behind the Gefilteria, and they have a beautiful new cookbook called the Gefilte Manifesto. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey and Liz. Hi, guys.
Hey, Sari.
Hey.
Hey. Jeffrey is actually a hologram. Liz is here in studio. Jeffrey's here in spirit,
yeah,
and also in voice, which is great. So we're gonna get into the nitty gritty of the Gefilte Manifesto. But first, we have some food news to discuss, I believe, if y'all don't mind. A couple interesting stories came out this week. The first, have you guys heard of Soylent?
Yes, of course.
The movie or.
Fair question.
The product Soylent Green. I definitely know that well.
Yes, this is actually the product. I know that they had this powder for a while, or maybe they still have it that people are drinking. People who are not like us, people who think that you should not have to take time out of your busy schedules to eat food. They have a new food bar that they have been marketing, and apparently it's making people violently ill.
So I'm not surprised. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's food.
It's not food. It's, in fact, Soylent. I guess they're not very concerned about it. They think that those are very, you know, very natural things to occur after you eat a Soylent bar. Becoming violently ill is something that's just par for the course. And the company says they're totally fine. But, yeah, I would not recommend them to your friends. I mean, you guys are cooks, so...
Yeah, I mean, usually when you eat something that's not food, you do get sick. So it makes sense to me that this is what would happen.
Yeah.
I like how Silicon Valley felt like it was important to disrupt food of all the things that they're disrupting. Like actual eating and food was what needed to be disrupted.
I mean, it's such a pain. You know, you have to take time out of your busy, like, tech schedules to, like, eat a meal and then all the chewing and the digesting.
I'm exhausted just thinking about it.
It's ridiculous. All right.
Having seen the movie Soylent Green, when basically you find out what actually goes into making Soylent and it's quite disgusting, it's surprising they would use that name.
It's a very strange marketing choice. I agree.
Yeah.
It is not selling it. All right. Moving on. Finally, what we've all been waiting for, Hello Kitty Wine is here. Yay. Are you guys into wine? Are you happy?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It is a sparkling rosé. I am not shocked to announce, although there's several different varieties of sparkling rosé. I mean, the thing that I really love about Hello Kitty Wine, besides everything, are all the different names of the the kind. I'm not going to say varietals because I don't think that's fair, but they have different names for different kinds of wines. There is Sweet Pink, which is a sparkling rosé. There is a Cupido, which is a sparkling white wine. There's Rosé, Rosé Collection, and also Charmy.
But how cute is the bottle?
The bottle is very cute. Yes. And I think that's what the most compelling part of the wine is definitely
that's
the bottle.
That's what I would imagine. Yeah.
Well,
but who is this marketed towards?
7-year-olds in Japan. Who are obviously drinking sparkling rosé.
Yeah, yeah. Because the Hello Kitty market and the wine market don't seem like they go together.
Until now, Jeffrey. Until now.
Yeah.
Making dreams come true for many people,
wow.
I'm sure. I personally love getting home from a long day of work and cracking open a bottle of Charmy. All right. And last but not leastest, speaking of interesting mashups, Taco Bell... has joined the Airbnb game. All your dreams.
I saw this.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Your fantasies of Airbnb-ing a Taco Bell.
No.
Yes. Yes. It's actually a contest. Like someone gets to win. Airbnb has, or and Taco Bell together have created this like fantasy Taco Bell house, pod, apartment, place.
Do you get to sleep in a tortilla?
Pretty much.
Because that sounds delicious and really comfortable, actually.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. There is a contest. I can give you information
Please
about
do.
It.
Yes.
Yeah, it's their new Steakcation. Get it? Instead of Staycation.
Oh, my gosh. I bet you our friend Adam Chandler is the de facto Taco Bell correspondent for The Atlantic, and I have a feeling he'll be there.
Yeah.
Lucky him. Well, we'll hope that he can live tweet his experience and give us that play-by-play. All right.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty good food news this week. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with the Gefilteria.
There are over 50,000 Chinese-American restaurants in the U.S. That's more than three times the number of McDonald's. How did Chinese-American food become so popular? And what's the story behind their unique menu of dishes like egg rolls and General's Chicken? Brooklyn's Museum of Food and Drink is going to explain it all with our next exhibition, Chow, the Making of Chinese-American Cuisine, featuring tastings, beautiful artifacts, and live demos of a fortune cookie machine. Visit chow.mofad.org to learn more, get advanced tickets, and help us make this exhibition a reality. Again, that's the Museum of Food and Drink at CHOW, chow.mofad.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. And today in studio, I have Jeffrey Yaskovitz and Liz Alpert. They are the duo behind the Gefilteria, a food company with the mission of reimagining Eastern European Jewish cuisine, adapting classic dishes to the values and tastes of a new generation. Their new cookbook is called The Gefilte Manifesto. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey and Liz, once again. Hi again.
Thank you. Hi. Hey, we're so glad to be here.
Yeah, you guys have a great new cookbook. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It is called The Gefilte Manifesto. And I guess my first question right off the bat is, what is a gefilte manifesto? Who knew that gefilte fish needed a manifesto?
We knew that gefilte fish needed a manifesto.
Conveniently enough, it was you.
Yeah, we were the ones who figured it out.
Yeah.
Jeffrey, do you want to tell the story of the manifesto a little bit? The actual manifesto?
Yeah, I mean, I can set the scene. It's a grim time for Ashkenazi cuisine. It felt like delis were closing. Our friend David Sachs wrote the book Save the Deli, all about sort of the dying institution. And there were this is about 2010 now, 2011. Maybe a couple of delis opened around the country. Young people of our generation, but. For, a majority of our friends and people, they have the assumption that Ashkenazi food, Eastern European Jewish foods, were represented by the kosher aisle in the supermarket. So that jar of gefilte fish was what people associated with the entire cuisine and also with gefilte fish.
That's a very sad state.
It was really sad. You know, Liz Bleak. Grew up never really eating gefilte fish because she thought it just came from a jar.
I did too.
Yeah, and so I grew up with the good stuff, but we ended up meeting and talking and feeling like we needed to do something, to talk about this cuisine in a new light, and we wrote a manifesto, and it felt like the place to start was with the ultimate symbol of how far things have gone astray, which was the jar of the gefilte fish. So we wrote a gefilte manifesto, which was actually just like a four-paragraph manifesto we printed on cards and gave out, and then 5-6 years later, we turned it into a cookbook.
And in the meantime, you guys also started a company,
right? So
you have been doing more than writing like a postcard,
yes,
about your ideas.
Yes, I mean we like to think that the manifesto was our mission statement. It was our call to action. So we started with the manifesto because. because we felt like we needed to make a declaration about what we were doing. But of course, we did a lot of cooking. We launched an artisanal gefilte fish that you can buy in stores now, today. We did events all over the country. We've done pop-ups. We've done markets. We've done festivals. We've written a cookbook. So we have done many things in the in-between. But manifesto is where it has begun, and it's pretty full circle right now.
Yeah. So you guys are definitely part of, I would say, like a larger kind of zeitgeist and cultural interest in the renewal and renaissance of Jewish foods, particularly Ashkenazi, which tends to get a bad rap. Where do you think, you know, including your own, like this renewed interest comes from? And obviously you guys have both tapped into it and have been a catalyst for this general renaissance taking place.
Where to begin with that question? There's so much. We could talk for a very long time about it. But I'd say that there's been a general renewed interest in food in our generation. So mm-hmm. So I think that that's a big part of it, that the landscape of food has just exploded. People from all different ethnic backgrounds are going back to their grandmother's kitchens and exploring the recipes and the traditions and the techniques that they found there. And people just love food. People are really excited about food. Part of our inspiration was looking around at other ethnic groups that were doing this and say, like, you know, kimchi makers, mm-hmm. Korean kimchi makers kind of reclaiming kimchi for their generation. Look at kimchi. Everybody, all they want to do is eat kimchi. So that was something we were really inspired
by.
That's
all I do all day.
I certainly eat too much kimchi.
Never too much.
Probably not. But, you know, I think one of the major things is just that we're in this moment where people are really excited about food. Our generation is excited about it. And why shouldn't we of this tradition, go back to our traditions too? So I think that's just one factor.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I would just add, Sari, that I think that it's no coincidence that the first delis sort of started opening by a younger generation during the recession. And we started our business during the recession. I don't know, this was a major disruption. And you know, for a while, I mean, I couldn't imagine, you know, before 2008 telling my parents that I was going to, you know, start a small food company in New York that was based around Ashkenazi food. Something felt okay 2 years later. And I would also just add that, you know, I think a lot of it has to do specifically with Jewish food. I completely agree with Leah. This is part of a much larger movement that's happening all across all different ethnic groups and religious groups and everything. You know, people are just thinking about food differently. But this is also the time when the older generation, people are getting old. You know, will they be able to continue to make these foods anymore? There was the feeling that we had when we started the business that maybe in order for this food to survive, we have to start doing something now. It felt urgent.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that what Jeff's not even saying is that one of the things that made us start our company is that his family experienced what we call the gefilte crisis, which was that his grandmother, who is still alive and she's amazing, who had made handmade gefilte fish his whole life, stopped making gefilte fish. And guess who it fell to? It fell to him, you know?
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Reading your book feels like, it feels like the food traditions, you know, embody the cultural traditions. And so can you just kind of riff a little bit about like what the connection between keeping these recipes alive and even, you know, updating them and readapting them, how does that keep cultural traditions also alive? And then why is it so vital to both of you? Why is it even important?
You know, Jewish life is really punctuated by holidays, and holidays mean eating meals together.
Yeah.
That is what Jewish life is. The Jewish calendar runs that way. It's basically like you can map out the meals that you're going to have during the week, during the year, and you kind of already know what you're going to eat. And our interest was twofold, I think. And one of them was saying, we want to eat these foods. This cuisine is so delicious. It's worth eating not just on the holidays. So that was also that we had a great deal of interest in that. But beyond that is we were less interested in preserving these foods as finding room for them on our tables, moving into the future. So we might have hosted a meal, but what we were seeing is instead of serving gefilte fish, people of our generation were serving sushi. right?
Yeah.
But gefilte fish is delicious. And so finding room on the table for traditional foods, finding ways to bring them back to their place of honor was really interesting to us. And not just on the holidays, but, you know, 365 days a year.
Yeah, I mean, especially with Reform Judaism in particular, I think, and I guess I can only speak for myself in this, like the connection that I feel having been raised Reform Jewish, the connection that I feel to religion at this point is through food. So if I feel a disconnect between a gefilte fish and a jar, I'm just not going to be that interested in the cultural significance behind it. But when, you know, I met you and Jeffrey and like went to one of your dinners for the first time and tasted your very imaginative, sustainable, healthy, delicious gefilte fish terrine, it was like recreating a connection to something in my past that felt like once again very significant for the first time.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting you brought up religion. I mean, we wrote this very much as an ethnic, you know, cultural cookbook, because that's what this food tradition is, right? Like, the religion, while the holidays are part of, you know, punctuating, you know, the year and kind of just determining what we're going to eat, this is very much an Ashkenazi book. This isn't a book, you know, about Jewish food culture all around the world. It was very specific to Eastern and Central Europe and to those flavors and those smells and to the kinds of foods that are available during those seasons, the harvest seasons and preserving the harvests. And so we really wanted to kind of focus on that. And that means that that's connected to Yiddish language, because it's all part of the same culture. We tried to work in bits of Yiddish folk wisdom and even quotes from Yiddish authors, because that's part of the cultural story, and it's one that sort of got watered down by kind of American culture, because, you know, it was so, all my grandparents were born in Poland. My parents' first language was not English, but they just wanted to become Americans so badly that they just sort of kind of pushed their cultural distinctions aside. Mm-hmm. And I think this is about reclaiming those and making them relevant again, not just to the religious aspects of our lives, but to the cultural aspects.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, you taught me actually the connection between seasonality and Ashkenazi cuisine, which was something that I had no idea. I mean, growing up, I had been served, you know, chopped liver and brisket and very just generally like brown, heavy foods. It would be great just to hear you talk a little bit about like the very authentic way that you have been reintroducing, you know, the recipes in your book, and also like how important seasonality actually is in this type of cuisine.
Yeah. I believe it was that pickle workshop that we were at PEX in Clinton Hill. And yeah, I mean, honestly, I first really started to understand Jewish cooking or Eastern European Jewish cooking while I was working on Adama, a Jewish organic farm up in Northwest Connecticut, just in the foothills of the Berkshires. And it was there that I was there in the summertime during a cucumber harvest, and it was 3 weeks where they honestly could not keep up with the bushels of cucumbers that were coming. And the farm, we would take the cucumbers, the garlic, the young uncured garlic straight from the field, and we took the dill that we harvested that very same day. We put them in barrels with salt water and spices, and waited 7 days, and we naturally fermented barrels of the best pickles I had ever eaten in my life. And these were live-cultured probiotic pickles, different than the Vlasics or the Claussens or, you know, even just any kind of quick vinegar pickle that you'd have. And so I learned about seasonal preservation. I learned about, oh, this is how I'm going to eat cucumbers through the year, because my ancestors were not getting cucumbers shipped from California. You know, if they wanted to eat cucumbers, they wanted to eat vegetables, you know, through the year. They're going to have to they're going to have to preserve them. Same thing with cabbage in the fall. And that was really big for me. But then also I started to understand that there was also a wisdom to Jewish eating. Going to the deli and eating a pastrami sandwich with a pickle, if it was a Jewish pickle, a probiotic pickle, it actually helps you digest that sandwich. And it also cleanses your palate from bite to bite, but there's a real wisdom to it. And so Liz and I, we're huge sauerkraut makers. So come fall, cabbage season, we're just making sauerkraut that we're going to have in our refrigerators it's going to last through the year. We may not have root cellars now, but we're really connected to also cooking with pickle brines and cooking with pickled cabbage, because that's what would have been available come fall, come wintertime. And of course, in the summertime and the springtime, you can eat fresher, lighter foods, and that's just part of the story of Ashkenazi cooking.
Mm-hmm. One of the little kind of nuggets in your cookbook that I enjoyed so much is a pickle metaphor. I mean, you kind of compare the process of fermentation and just active change that happens when a vegetable is preserved to the way that you've adapted your recipes.
Yeah, we believe in keeping the core, mm-hmm. right? It's a cucumber. You know it's still a cucumber. But it's alive and it's changing all the time. And we're just enhancing the cucumber based on what's available and what makes sense and the flavors that we want. So, yeah, thank you for recognizing that. We like that metaphor.
Thank you for writing it. Liz, did you have an experience kind of similar to the way Jeffrey had sort of, an awakening at this pickle farm? Did you have something in your life that kind of stimulated you and kind of like activated this curiosity and this like DIY Ashkenazi cuisine or something like that for you?
You know, I don't have that exact moment that Jeffrey can describe, but I always loved food, and I always, you know, really looked forward to the holidays. And for me, a lot of what changed for me was I was working for Joan Nathan, the very well known Jewish cookbook author, and it was during that time that we were making everything from scratch, and I really got to see, I got to kind of pull back the curtain and see what's going on with these foods. These aren't just foods that are delivered through a jar, through a box, through, even just to my table from somebody else's magical kitchen. This is something that I can make. And the more that I was making these foods by hand and like seeing the process, the more I loved them and the more I felt like they were mine and that I could make them even better. And the more I wanted to continue to develop them. And so I spent a good couple of years just making so many Jewish foods from scratch all the time. And you just can't go back from that, mm-hmm. right? You cannot change after you've seen that.
Yeah. When I was reading, you got the book and you guys were talking about like rendering your own fat to make schmaltz, which is, you know, something that was very commonplace back in the day, but now people don't really take the time to do that anymore. Are there foods that you felt like almost went on, became extinct, like we're on the brink of extinction, but since, you know, with this kind of like renewed interest, have made a comeback?
I'm not sure that this quite qualifies, but I would say one of the things we have in the book, we make a cheese blintz, and we start by making the cheese, the farmer's cheese. And I would say that cheese blintzes are still quite popular. Liz and I both grew up eating those coming from a frozen box. You know, they were never made by my parents. They were only made by my grandmother, who eventually stopped making them. And so kind of what we jokingly call a curd to crepe blintz, like making it like from the whole milk and then making the crepes and then wrapping them and, you know, flavoring them in that kind of way. For me, that was like when we did it ourselves, it was the first time I ever had it that way. And that was pretty big for me.
Yeah, and we also there's four recipes in our book for kvass, which is a drink, which is a fermented drink. It's very common in Russia. And if you talk to any Russian, they'll know what kvass is. And it's usually made from fermenting old rye bread. And essentially the kvass that you can get now, which you can get in Russian markets, is really a malt soda. Coca-Cola is the biggest producer of kvass. But traditionally it was a fermented drink that made use of extra things that you had around, and it's generally probiotic, and it can be made from the old rye bread that's stale. It can be made from beets that have gone that you're not quite going to eat anymore because they're not so great. It's kombucha is called tea kvass. You can make it from lettuce, which is definitely something that we could talk for a long time about. That for sure was on its way to extinction, and we were lucky enough to.
I understand why, I think.
It's delicious.
I believe
you.
You
can try it, Sarah.
You
love it.
That one was extinct.
It was actually extinct. Yeah, and so we have these four recipes for kvass, for these delicious, bubbly, exciting fermented beverages made the old-fashioned way. And that fits into the larger trend of what we're interested in, a lot of people are interested in today. But they're really, I mean, these are old world drinks. So yeah, that's another fun example. And actually, they're quite easy to make. And the process is very passive. It's really about time and just creating the right conditions.
Mm-hmm. You have a couple foods in your cookbook that I found very surprising. Well, first, pickle brine bread I had never tasted until I had tasted it because Jeffrey made it, or you guys both made it together and Jeffrey served it to me, which was delicious. And then your fruit soups were also something I'd never heard of before. Where did you uncover those recipes?
I can speak about
you talk about the pickle bread, Liz.
Yes. So the pickle bread, there's two parts of that story. And one is that Jeffrey and I make a lot of pickles. You know, we have this whole pickle chapter, and you always end up with leftover pickle brine. And part of the ethos of this book is don't waste anything, use everything, because our ancestors would never have thrown away a delicious, flavorful, probiotic, liquid. They would use it. I mean, why would you throw something like that out? So we're always looking for different ways to use pickle brine, and the book has quite a few of them, including pickle brine bread, which was something that a friend of mine, her mother, had said after tasting my pickles. You know, I used to make this pickle brine bread from one of those old school cookbooks from the 70s. She ended up sending me the cookbook. It wasn't Diet for a Small Planet, but it was of that era, and it was one of those, like, quote-unquote, like, really healthy back-to-the-land recipes. Yeah. And so we started there and then developed it, and we said, what an amazing use for this pickle brine, because you need a lot, and when you're making pickles, you have a lot. And just what a great way to make a sour bread.
Yeah, it is so good.
Yeah, awesome. And then and for the fruit soups, you know, there's actually, I mean, you know, I grew up always hearing about a sour cherry soup that would be served, you know, so basically during cherry season, you know, you would make your jams and your preserves, but you also, you know, you had enough leftover cherries that you'd make a soup. And so I always heard about it. I never really grew up eating it, but I knew that it was often available at the Jewish dairy restaurants, which aren't really around that much like they used to be, places like Ratner's in the Lower East Side. And when we were looking through the Vilna Vegetarian Cookbook, which is a cookbook that was just translated from Yiddish a couple of years ago, but it was actually a book written in 1938 by Fania Lewando of Yiddish foods, Jewish cooking in Vilna. And there was a recipe for blueberry soup, and we made it, and that recipe was pretty bland and just like kind of like a blueberry drink, but we decided to kind of play with it and go from there, and we researched Scandinavian fruit soup traditions, and really it's a great way to use your abundance of fruit during the harvest seasons, and it's really light and refreshing. We love it, and it's one of the ones we love to demonstrate for how to do, because it's just it's unexpected.
I was surprised.
Also, everyone thinks Jewish food is heavy and brown like you thought, and this is just so bright and colorful and light, and we just really appreciate, you know,
and also just the image of spiced blueberry soup. I guess also, like, spices aren't something I think of very often when I think of Ashkenazi cuisine, so that sounded just very just exciting and unusual. Sort of on that topic, there is a lot of kind of interesting cultural cross-pollination in the cookbook, like Ashkenazi kimchi. You mentioned kimchi. How do recipes like these fit in your lexicon of updated Jewish foods?
So when we were writing the cookbook, we were in a constant conversation about what to include and what not to include. And I can just say that overall, we really support the idea that this cuisine is always in conversation with itself. Jeffrey and I do not agree on many, many things, as the book demonstrates. We have wildly different opinions on what fits and what doesn't fit. And we try and put that out there because there is no right way to do it. And we're always doing things, and people say, yeah, but the way my mother did it, that's the way you're supposed to do it. And we are really behind the idea that there is no right way to do things. There's always a conversation happening. And with ingredients, we had that conversation all the time. You know, what can we include and what can't we include? And what we tried to do was stick with the core. So we tried to say, well, we really want to stay true to ingredients that are available in Eastern Europe and Central Europe. You know, we want to stay true as we can to the seasons and what our ancestors would have used at that time. But we've made room for ingredients that we really think are part of our culinary vernacular today. So today we, you know, it's not crazy to have a hot pepper around, and it's not, you know, it seems okay. It's, to me, it's very common to have a hot pepper. So that didn't seem like a huge stretch, but I can tell you that there's things that we didn't include. You know, we don't do fusion cuisine, right? So we're not using fish sauce. We're not using, you know, I mean, there's probably some scallions in the book. Scallions are available in Eastern Europe. I'm trying to think. There's a debate Jeffrey and I have about whether ginger belongs in the Ashkenazi kimchi. I think it does because that's something that we use today. Jeffrey just doesn't think it quite fits into the canon.
What say you there, Jeffrey?
Well, I would say, strangely, I feel like it's okay to have beets and ginger in our beet kvass, but somehow in the kimchi, the ginger made it too unfamiliar.
Gotta draw the line somewhere.
You know, when I was on the Jewish pickle farm, they were making a kimchi, a little bit, a different version than this, but really it was just called kimchi, but it was very much just a fermented cabbage-based kraut-like food. And so our Ashkenazi kimchi is essentially, it's kind of like a sauerkraut plus, and we, you know, called it kimchi because we used some both some of the heat and some of the spice and some of the similar methods of making kimchi to do it. But really, it's fermented cabbage at the end of the day. Yeah, there's green cabbage and Napa cabbage. You know, we offer, you can use daikon radishes or you can use turnips. And we really wanted to be thoughtful about that, really, you know, because like Liz said, thinking about the culinary vernacular and also what's just available in your supermarkets and your CSAs and at your supermarket and at your specialty markets. So we were just, so the kimchi. Also, we were inspired by Korean kimchi makers who were so proud of their tradition. Like Liz had mentioned earlier, that I remember being at Pickle Day in the Lower East Side in 2009, and there were four new kimchi companies, and it was just this like moment of like, wow, like this is a reclamation happening, and I was inspired to get involved in Ashkenazi cuisine because of them, and so it felt only natural to include our own version of a kimchi in the book, and we do have a kimchi stuffed cabbage, and the way that we rationalized that was that stuffed cabbage would often be made, especially in the Hungarian tradition, with sauerkraut. You'd put sauerkraut at the bottom of your pan. You'd sometimes put sauerkraut inside the cabbage roll itself. And so you can use your sauerkraut, but why not also use your Ashkenazi kimchi inside that stuffed cabbage? And that's just sort of the genesis of that recipe.
Sounds good to me. Nostalgia is certainly a reoccurring theme throughout the book, and especially the way it's expressed through foods. And it's very potent, I think, especially when you guys recreate this Latvian picnic in one of the sections of the book. What are you trying to achieve by connecting the dots between food and history in the cookbook?
It's a big question, Sarah.
I know. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
Go ahead, Liz.
Why don't you start?
Okay, I'll go. So for me, nostalgia is obviously so important. I just wrote a Jewish cookbook. I mean, for goodness sakes, I'm clearly driven. There's clearly a nostalgia for something I never even experienced, you know, and my life the last 2 years has literally been driven by that nostalgia. What I would say is that our goal is to move beyond just nostalgia. And my interest personally is having people live this food today, make it a part of their life today, create new memories, new pieces that they can reference. I don't want people to think that this is just about their grandmothers or their great-grandmothers. This is like about right now in Brooklyn, in California, in wherever you are. This is alive. This is happening. And so... While nostalgia is clearly a driver, and we meet people all the time who are so, they come to us because of nostalgia. Mm-hmm. But my hope is that they leave this, like they go beyond that, just that feeling when they've read the book or when they've met us. And I think that's because I'm less interested in preserving and more interested in seeing these traditions continue in an interesting and dynamic way.
Well, that's
lovely. Yeah, and we really tried not to put kitsch into the book. You know, often when you talk about Jewish food, everything's so, it's like, you know, everyone's always like, oh, you should call it not your Bubby's brisket or something like that. Right? It's like, you know, and somehow
all the time,
you know, all these puns and all this stuff. We really, wanted to go a level deeper. We always kind of try to push ourselves there. And we really want to believe and want people to walk away feeling a pride in this food tradition, maybe who grew up with it, and people who aren't familiar with it to see a wisdom and a beauty to it that isn't always there the way we talk about it now. And so we try to weave in history, and I wouldn't say, like, for us it wasn't about nostalgia, but it was about emotion. It was about stories that really kind of convey, like, what these foods have meant throughout history to our families, but also beyond that. And so I think with this book, we really tried to distill those feelings, those ideas into a coherent narrative to kind of basically make the case that this is an actual food tradition, that actual cuisine that makes sense and that matters. And I think it's kind of crazy that we sort of had to do that. It's because people really, especially people who grew up eating deli foods and just rich holiday foods and nothing else, there's this idea that these foods don't make sense, that they're just kind of a collection, a hodgepodge of fatty brown foods. And we really think there's something much deeper here.
I think you achieved that in a really, really successful way. And I wanted to ask, you know, with all this excitement happening right now in the past couple of years, like surrounding Jewish foods and specifically this kind of renaissance, do you think we're at sort of peak Jewish food saturation at this point in time, or do you think we're not even close?
We have been doing this pretty actively since 2011, 2012, and every year people ask us that question. And every year...
I fail, I quit.
No. The reason I point that out is because every year there's somebody on, you know, whatever panel discussion we're on who says, yeah, you know, we're getting there.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey and I always kind of take a little bit more of a neutral stance, A, because it's not good for business. You know, I hope we keep going.
Yeah.
but also it's like, I mean, we keep going. We keep growing. There's more excitement. There's more places opening up every day. There's more people that are calling us because they're doing some interesting pop-up or a restaurant or a project. And so I don't think we're at peak. I think that actually we're maybe at a stabilizing place. So it's like maybe we're not going to see this continued explosion, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And I put that in air quotes because we're in Brooklyn, so maybe it doesn't feel like an explosion other places. I don't know. But it certainly feels like one.
I think that we're just, I mean, you know, I feel like we're speaking in New York, right? We're speaking, you know, from a little bubble of a world. I mean, we were just, one of the benefits of getting to go on a book tour is you get to go and meet people in all these different parts of the country. We were just in the South, and we met multiple people who want to start bagel shops and delis who were like talking with us about it, and we're so excited about it. And this is, we're talking like deep South. You know, we're going out West, and we know all these chefs, many of whom haven't yet started the project, but they really want to. So I feel like there's a lot that's about to happen, and I feel like for a while, it was a little uncertain. One of my favorite little quotes was from Mitchell Davis of the James Beard Foundation. After at a Jewish food panel, one of the many. This one's about gefilte fish at the Center for Jewish History, and someone asked him, "What do you think the future of Jewish food will be?" And I think he said something like, "I'm not sure what the future of Jewish food will be, but I can tell you the future of Jewish food panels is looking really bright."
And
it's because, like, you know, honestly, there's like all the funny thing is about Jews and food is that Jews want to talk about food so much. There's so many panels about the future of Jewish food, what's happening. So it almost feels like there's a saturation. Like, it feels like there's too much happening, but I mean, it's actually quite small. There's, you know, only a handful of delis that have opened, and only a handful of appetizing shops, and not that many businesses. But it's growing, and I think there's a lot of room for it to grow.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Did you guys have any kind of recipe fails in your process of creating recipes? Like, did anything just, you know, it felt really ambitious and exciting at the time, but didn't quite make the cut?
I can think of one example. I mean, we cooked so much.
Yeah.
We made so many recipes. There was so much that didn't make it.
Did anything just bomb?
Yeah, we did one. So Jeffrey referenced the Vilna Vegetarian Cookbook, which was a cookbook, you know, translated from Yiddish, and it has recipes like mix eggs with leeks, cook it like a frittata, you know, and that's like your recipe, right? And so we were really inspired by this. This is a primary resource. There's not that many. There's very few resources like that. So we were really inspired by it, and we were actually doing catering for the launch party of that book. And we tried to make a pickle soup. And the pickle soup, I can remember we had like, you know, 3 quarts of it, and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And I actually was in Poland this summer, and somebody asked me, somebody who's Polish asked me if I'd ever made pickle soup, and I told them about the fail, and they sent me a recipe for something, but it was, again, it wasn't quite a recipe, but they sent me some guidelines. They wanted me to try it again. But I remember that being a really terrible thing to have in my fridge every day and have to look at.
Well, maybe for the next cookbook.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Maybe not.
Maybe. Yeah. For me, I guess I would say I really wanted pickled lettuce. Like, I really, because we were making
really
this lettuce
did.
Kvass, and then I the reason we made lettuce kvass is because we had read, there was an article by an academic about the lost tradition of pickled lettuce, and it talked about both lettuce kvass and the actual, you know, pickled leaves. And so I just loved the idea of eating like a crunchy, tasty lettuce on top of a sandwich to like bring it all home. Like that would be the pickle, that would be the flavor.
Great.
I just like I had this vision, and I tried and I tried and I tried, and it just kept getting slimy or just not very appetizing. And we tried, I don't know, probably 6 different types of pickled lettuce, different types of leaves,
lettuce.
different
types of techniques,
different grind strengths. Some sweet, some not sweet.
Yeah.
And it just ultimately we decided it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of a bummer. I'm not done with it.
Don't give up.
I just haven't found the right leaf, but I don't think that it wasn't good enough for the book.
next round. This
yes.
has been fantastic. We're going to take a little break. Stick with us, Liz, Jeffrey, and everyone else listening, because we are going to be back with the morning after quiz. We're back. You're listening to The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. I have been having a really thoughtful and lovely conversation with Liz Alpert and Jeffrey Oskovitz of the Gefilteria. That was really, just so fun and cool and interesting to hear about your process with the cookbook. But we're going to shift gears a little bit. We are now moving into The Morning After quiz zone. So this is a very silly quiz. It's 3 questions. They are multiple choice. Each question has 3 potential answers. And the point is to give you a quiz on something that you really should know nothing about, except it's sort of tangentially related to something you know a lot about, which is the Gefilte Manifesto. But this quiz is instead about the Communist Manifesto, written by Karl Marx. You didn't see that one coming.
Nervous.
Yes. I do not expect you to get any answers right, but if you do, bonus.
What do we win?
You win, I don't
well,
like
it
a lifetime.
Should be noted that it was Marx and Engels, right? We like to think that most manifestos require 2 authors.
Jeffrey, you just really ruined my first question.
Oh no.
I'm not surprised you knew the answer to that.
ask it anyway and we'll get it right.
Okay, fine. All right. So
hey, Jeffrey, you take the first question.
Not
okay?
Everyone knows. Okay, so who is credited with co-writing the Communist Manifesto? Is it A, Peter Best? Is it B, Friedrich Engels? Or C, Gracchus Babeuf?
I think it's C.
Almost. Do you know who Gracchus Babeuf is?
I don't actually. Obviously, it's B, Engels, but I don't know. Who is C?
He is a guy who started a different organization, I think called like the League of Just, which was one of the inspirational organizations that Friedrich Engels and Karl Marx joined. And I don't know if you caught, but the option for A, Peter Best, he's the 5th Beatle.
Wow.
Oh. Which is sort of what I was thinking about when I was thinking of like Friedrich Engels, because no one really gives him credit except for you, Jeffrey. You give him credit.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty funny.
I always identify with the angles of the group, so I feel like I want to give him the credit.
That's very sweet. Yes. Yeah, that's very sweet. Okay, so moving on to the second question, which was not a short-term demand outlined in the Communist Manifesto? A, progressive income tax, B, free public education, or C, universal health care? Remember, which is not a short-term demand.
I have an idea, Liz. What about you?
I was thinking A. What do you think?
A is progressive income tax.
I was thinking A, too.
All right. So let's do it. A.
Well, very good guess. But the answer is universal health care was not a short-term demand.
Wow.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It didn't enter it, as far as I know. But he did ask for progressive income tax and free public education.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Learn something new every day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why did the Central Committee of the Communist League send Karl Marx an ultimatum letter in late January of 1948? Was it because A, after being arrested for 18 hours in Brussels, he was told to keep a low profile after being accused of bringing too much negative attention to the Communist Party? Was it B, because he hadn't turned his manuscript in on time? Or was it C, because he had failed to show up at a major rally where he was supposed to read passages from the manifesto?
Ooh.
What do you think, Jeffrey?
Oh, my gosh. I was going to say A, but I kind of want to say C.
I kind of want to say C. Let's say C.
Because he failed to show up. It's actually B, and I did it.
That was
like a special one for you guys.
Terribly.
He actually didn't turn his manuscript in on time.
I thought you were doing that
really?
As a joke.
No, because I had to include it, and I was like, oh, you guys are going to love this. The Communist Party sent him an ultimatum letter. Because it took him so long to turn in the manifesto, they sent it in late January and they demanded it by February 1st.
Oh.
And it turned out he actually wrote the whole Communist Manifesto in like 6 or 7 weeks.
Damn, I wish we had written our book in 6 or 7 weeks. Just kidding, I don't wish that.
Well, I thought that would hit close to home. Having just completed a cookbook.
As an author, you know, that deadline's a tough one.
Yeah. You know what? Communists, they're just like us. Thanks, David. All right, guys, that's our show. Thank you so much, Liz and Jeffrey. You have been fantastic guests. Tell us where we can find you on social media.
You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Gefilteria. That's GEFILTERIA. And Gefilteria.com and GefilteManifesto.com.
Yeah, and buy their book because it's really, really beautiful.
And we're on tour right now, so we're doing lots of fun stuff out and about in the world.
And if you get a chance, eat their food if they're ever cooking it somewhere near you, because it is very delicious.
Thanks so much, Sari. What a pleasure it's been.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks, Liz. Thanks for listening, everyone. Check us out next week. Again, same time, same place, Sunday, 3 o'clock, heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.